Why are we talking about 9/11, 14 years after the fact? Today the flags are at half-mast, all over the country, radio talk shows are talking about what happened, and oh, isn't we came together, and oh gosh, those evil terrorists. Why are we talking about it still? And I would submit to you tonight, we're talking about it here, because everything that is happening today is a result of 9/11. Okay, when we talk about it, when we talk about the Patriot Act, the TSA, Homeland Security, loss of liberty, never-ending wars against terrorism, this huge flood of immigrants that are coming into, illegal aliens, what do you want to call them, coming into Europe and sending many of them here too. When we get our minds around the full spectrum fraud that is 9/11, if you can come to grips with the fact that 9/11 didn't happen like they told you it happened, that there were forces behind it, that we're not just some guy in a cave 7,000 miles away. If you can come to grips with that in your mind, all of a sudden you begin to see the bigger picture. And I would submit to you, for those of you who are LDS, one of the biggest reasons the Book of Mormon was for our day was to expose false flag terrorism. From Amalickiah, does anybody ring a bell? Amalickiah's false flag terrorism that he pulled. To expose evil from within the government, within other organizations that have power and control, lusting for power and control. So I don't want to go long because we have a speaker waiting, but let me just read a quick excerpt from Dr. Paul Craig Roberts in today's article at Infowars.com. And I'd suggest that you, if you're looking for truth, you're not going to get it from Fox News, from CNN, from MSNBC, from the talking bubbleheads. You're not going to get it there. You've got to dig deeper. You've got to determine that you're going to look for alternative sources, and then search and make sure that it's true. Do your source data work. Okay, today on InfoWars, Dr. Craig Roberts wrote the following. Quote, 9/11, 14 years later, Washington's 14-year and ongoing slaughter of Muslims and the destruction of their countries are war crimes for which the U.S. government's official 9/11 conspiracy theory was catalyst. Millions of refugees from Washington's wars are currently overrunning Europe, and Washington's 14-year... factual evidence and science do not support Washington's conspiracy theory. The 9/11 Commission did not conduct an investigation. It was not permitted to investigate. The Commission sat and listened to the government's story and wrote it down. Afterwards, the chairman and the co-chairman of the Commission said that the Commission was set up to fail. You can read about that yourself in the 9/11 Commission report. Some of you know that 28 pages was classified and never released. But senators and congressmen who have seen it recently have said that everything in here is just completely bunk, and that the ones behind it were the Saudis and Mossad. Not Saddam Hussein, not Afghanistan, not Al-Qaeda. So take it for what it's worth there. Continue with Paul Craig Roberts. He wrote the following again. The following account below of the government's 9/11 conspiracy theory reads like a parody, but in fact is an accurate summary of the official 9/11 conspiracy theory. The official version goes like this. Directed by a beardy guy from a cave in Afghanistan, 19 hard-drinking, coke-snorting, devout Muslims enjoy lap dances before their mission to meet Allah. Using nothing more than craft knives, they overpower cabin crew, passengers, and pilots on four different airplanes. And hangover or not, they manage to give the world's most sophisticated air defense system the slip, unfazed by leaving their how-to-fly-a-passenger-jet guide in the car at the airport. They mastered the controls in no time and scored direct hits on two towers, causing three towers to completely collapse. The laws of physics fail, and the world watches in awe as symmetrical damage and scattered low-temperature fires cause steel-frame buildings to collapse symmetrically through their own mass at free-fall speed for the first time in history. Despite their dastardly cunning and superb planning, they give their identity away by using explosion-proof passports, which survive the destruction of steel and concrete and fall to the ground, where they are quickly discovered lying on the top of a mass of debris. Meanwhile, it goes on and on. I'd suggest that you go look at it tonight. It's quite interesting. But the anomalies and impossibilities of the official narrative go on and on, not to mention Building 7, which most of you know about. And if you don't, I would Google the term Building 7, WTC Building 7. So we're excited to bring you our best-selling author and researcher, Rebecca Roth. She's had a 30-year career as a flight flight attendant and international purser for a major airline. She's been described as the foremost 9/11 researcher because of her uncovering new evidence that has been buried for years. She has appeared on numerous radio shows, including Coast to Coast with George Norrie. She's been on the radio all day today, and we're grateful to have her here. She goes on with Jeff Rentz tonight at 10 o'clock, so we have to cut off at a reasonable hour. She's written two books, Methodical Illusion, published in October of 2014, which rose to be a bestseller at number 9 overall with Amazon, and her new book, which we have copies of here tonight. Michael, would you raise your hand? That's her publisher over there, so if you're interested in the book, they have autographed copies, a limited supply of each book. Her new book, Methodical Deception, was just released last week, I believe, and we have about 30 copies of that. So with all that, we would like to give a warm applause and welcome to Rebecca Roth.
Hello. All right. Well, first off, I just would like to take just a minute to introduce myself for those of you who are not aware of who I am and why I'm here. My name is Rebecca Roth, and I am an author. I am a retired flight attendant of approximately 30 years. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist, although some people might like to tag me as that now. But in 2000, I'd retired from flying after around 30 years in around 2004. And around 2008, I thought I would write a novel. And so I wanted to bring in a fictitious character into my novel who was from the Middle East. And I wanted to use a name, and I didn't really know any. So I Google searched the 19 Arab hijackers from 9/11. And just like probably all of you, I thought the same thing that the media still to this very day is trumping as reality. Lo and behold, up in front of me came an article from the BBC dated September 23rd, 2001, just shortly after the event, that claimed the Saudi government was suing the FBI and the United States government for stealing the identity, and indeed six of the accused hijackers were still alive. And so that got my attention because I remember seeing all this unfold on television. And although as an airline professional who had studied crashes for 30 years, I knew that there was no plane crash at the Pentagon because there was no plane parts there. There was no crash site there. And planes cannot go. Aluminum planes do not, unlike what they're trying to show you and tell you on television, do not go into buildings, especially brick buildings. And the Pentagon, being the most guarded building of the entire world, with the Patriot missile batteries and three levels of security. I later on found out they'd been turned off by our own government and military, but it was the most secure building in the world, and it had just recently been reinforced with Kevlar and steel, and it was brick. And if you're familiar with the layout of the Pentagon, it's got all these layers, and they're kind of like hallways that go all the way around this Pentagon shape. And I remember Jamie McIntyre from CNN saying, well, there's no plane crash here. There's no plane. So obviously they don't disappear. And then also the crash at Shanksville, I knew there was no plane there either because planes don't disappear. It didn't land in quicksand. It's a very big aircraft, 757. And so again, I knew that was impossible, but like a lot of people, I believed what I was told on the television and on the news, until I discovered the hijackers were still alive. And once I made that discovery, I knew that things were going wrong. And all of a sudden, those red flags that I saw, cell phones cannot work at altitude. And I was hearing that a lot that morning when they were just starting to tell us about the flight attendants and the crew members and the passengers calling in on their cell phones. I thought to myself, no, they weren't. They couldn't, because they don't work. And trust me, every one of us, and probably you guys too, when you're traveling as passengers, turn on your cell phone to see if you have any bars. I mean, everybody does it. And so we all knew, and I knew, that cell phones don't work. And at that time, they cut off around 1,800 feet, maybe up to 3,000 if you were leaving a specific city and happened to be flying over a cell phone tower of the company that your cell phone was with. So I saw red flags, and I remember the minute my phone rang and someone on the call said, "Turn on your television." And I did, just in time to see a 767 float through a steel building, the World Trade Center towers. I'd been in them like a hot knife through butter. And I thought it was a replay, modern version of the War of the Worlds. I thought it was trick photography because, in my airline mind, having studied crashes for 30 years, airplanes are made of aluminum. They don't do well with a bird strike. Hail will take them down. And I had seen damage from birds and hail, and I knew that planes can't do that. So I just couldn't figure out how it was done. And yet on the television, they kept telling me it was these 19 Arabs and how these planes were commandeered and by these guys that couldn't fly. They all flunked flight school, and I started looking into it. Once I discovered the hijackers were still alive, I set that novel aside. And I was a chemistry major. I studied organic and biochemistry in college. And when you're going through school, you think to yourself, "I'll never use calculus, or I'll probably never use this algebra." And I sure thought I would probably never, ever use organic chemistry. But what that allowed me to do was to dissect what happened on the planes and on the ground, and just to do that kind of research. And so I dove in. I spent thousands of hours looking into what else went on besides those hijackers living through that I didn't know as a TV viewer. Now, I had just come home from a trip in Europe, and I'd worked as a purser. So I knew that the FAA wasn't warning us. I'd never been told of Osama bin Laden or a terrorist group named Al-Qaeda ever. So when they were telling me this on television, I was thinking, who are these guys in Afghanistan in a cave? They're doing this? How did they take control of NORAD and our military? Because I'd had jet scrambled before, and they take about 6 minutes. And so I couldn't make any sense out of it. And so what happened to me, I just sort of did what a lot of people have done. I put it on a shelf. And it wasn't until I discovered those hijackers were still alive that I took it off the shelf and faced it. Now, this is not an easy thing to do, and it wasn't easy for me. But since I knew from the get-go that cell phones didn't work, that planes don't fly into buildings and disappear, and they don't fly into the ground and make a divot with no titanium engines, and those are really big, 8 to 9 foot in diameter engines, a landing gear doesn't disappear. And luggage and people and bodies and all that stuff. There's always stuff. You remember seeing what happened with German wings recently, and it kind of blew up in a mountain, but there was luggage and people and bodies and parts all over, and that's normal. But not on 9/11. Nothing was normal. And when I went back to work and asked, when we were in our yearly training about it, oh my goodness, it was like I was asking a taboo question. And we were never given privileged information because the FAA never told us anything. So as I went into this, I discovered things that happened on 9/11 that I'll bet a lot of you don't know. And so what I did was, once I discovered all of this, I'll put some notes up here, I didn't know what to do with all the information. But my first commitment was to find what really happened to the planes, the passengers, and the crew members on those four flights, because I already knew that what they were telling us absolutely was impossible from the cell phone calls on down. Well, what I discovered after the hijackers were still alive were things like insurance fraud, stolen gold, precious metals that were in vaults underneath several buildings in the World Trade Center complex. Building 6, if you've never Google searched that and looked, Building 6 crate was cratered, and that was holding the U.S. Customs House and also a lot of very valuable precious metals and that sort of thing. Under Building 4, which also never gets mentioned but was basically disintegrated, and under the towers, leaving underneath the towers, were found a couple trucks that somehow somebody knew They needed to be leaving the vaults underneath the Bank of Nova Scotia and through the World Trade Center towers, and they were full of gold. And two of them, unfortunately, for the people who had an inkling that those towers were about to fall down, and they were removing the gold and precious metals, the trucks broke down, and so they got stuck under there. So when the rescue guys went in there and they're starting to dig, and this is one reason why the government of the United States, FEMA, and the FBI and the CIA all got there, and there were no cameras allowed. The cameraman that was there is now living in Argentina and under in exile because he had taken hours of video photography of what he found in the first month under the towers and under the rubble that was there. And apparently he found something that the American United States government didn't want any of you and me to find out, because they framed him for the murder of his wife, and he got out because they didn't have, he went to a trial, I believe, four times. They had no evidence on him. This is a FEMA photographer, by the way. This is a government employee. This is how they treated him. And so I discovered another thing that was really interesting to me as well, is that there weren't really any Jewish people in the towers. Now, these were financial centers for insurance and banking and stock market stuff. And there's a company in Israel called Odigo, and it's a text messaging service that anyone that's Jewish can sign up to, and they can get warnings. Well, Odigo set out a warning that morning before anything hit the towers to not go to work in the World Trade Center towers to all of these Jewish people that were signed up. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. And so I started to, then I'd seen so many coincidences. There was a Brady Bond that was created by George H.W. Bush in 1991. And this was done using fraudulent gold bonds and stolen gold from the Soviet Union. And this was done as part of their financial collapse. Now, most of you, if you're out on the internet, you're hearing that we're looking at a financial collapse in this country. This is something that usually precedes a big event or a war or something along that line. So we actually, our government and compliments of the CIA and George H.W. Bush, we set up these Brady bonds. They were worth $240 billion, and they were expiring, believe it or not, September 12th, 2001. They were held, believe it or not, in the offices that were directly hit Cantor Fitzgerald. And these were the real paper certificates for these. So of course they're gone now. They disappeared and disintegrated just like everything else, except lots of the paper you saw go down. Now that we looked at towers that were completely turned into dust, and lots of the metal and steel from the structure was shot out, 300 yards or more, some of it. We saw cars that were looked like they'd been bombed out as far away as a mile and a quarter from the towers. Nobody really showed you that, but it's out there. And then all these weird things, like the paper didn't burn, but you looked and you see all this dust after the towers collapsed, and there was, ankle deep or almost knee deep some places of papers that had come out of the towers. And so whatever hit the towers didn't want to burn paper, but it sure took its toll on those towers. So we were told those towers fell because of jet fuel and office fires. Well, now I'd actually had a little firefighting experience, so I knew that was really pretty impossible. And I started to see things that were, I couldn't even call them coincidences anymore. And so when I finally found in an FBI document the transcripts from the flight attendants from Flight 11, that was the first flight that supposedly hit the North Tower. And there I was in my element. I had two flight attendants talking about a hijacking. And so I got into looking at every word they said, and this is how I discovered what I discovered. Betty Ong called a reservations line. Number one, that would be crazy. Number two, you would not make a phone call during a hijacking if a real hijacker were on your plane. Because what the FAA protocols were in a hijacking is to sit down, take off your wings and name tag, cover yourself with a coat or blanket, and do not draw attention to yourself. So the last thing you would want to do is sit on a telephone call. And yet, both of the flight attendants on Flight 11 called out on two different phones. One called on a cell phone and one called on an installed airphone on the plane, according to the official story. But Betty, on-call reservations, which you're usually on hold 10 to 20 minutes, it's just not where you would call in an emergency like a hijacking would if you could get a call out. Like I said, protocol was not to call anyone, so except the pilots. And so all of our communication would have been done through the pilots. So what I did was I looked real carefully with my flight attendant eyes and ears. And I heard Betty Ong say, he, as in one hijacker, he has sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class, and we can't breathe in business class. And I thought, uh-oh. There's something wrong with this story. I wonder why would she say that? Because every flight attendant, and probably you do too when I point it out to you, has had an experience where someone sprayed cheap perfume or spilled a bottle of, or a big bottle of duty-free alcohol or rum or something that really smelled, and or even vomited. And you know, once that happens on board a pressurized cabin, everyone in the cabin is going to smell whatever it is. And so she said he sprayed pepper spray or mace in business class, and we can't breathe up there. And I thought, no, if you sprayed pepper spray or mace in a pressurized cabin, the hijackers would have sprayed themselves, the passengers would have been having a problem, and whoever was at the helm at flying the plane also would be suffering from pepper spray or mace. And so I thought, well, that's really interesting, because she was on the phone for 27 minutes, so was the other flight attendant. And neither one of them ever complained about eyes watering or coughing or choking or anything like that. They never ever mentioned it again, nor did they show any signs of pepper spray or mace. So Betty Ong then said this, and this is what really got my attention too. She said, he stood upstairs. Well, that probably means nothing to you unless you've been on some airplanes and know that there's only one aircraft with stairs. That's a 747, and she was on a 767. So I thought, well, there are stairs in a hangar. They are making these long phone calls, and then it dawned on me. She said that the pilots aren't, we can't communicate with the pilots. The pilots are not answering their phone. And then I remembered that in the early 90s, a company sold a product to Boeing called the flight termination system. And this is actually how we still operate our drones around the world from different Air Force bases like Creech, Nevada. And they sold it using this. In the event of a hijacking and a hijacker should take control of the cockpit, we can land the aircraft remotely where it will be liberated by a hostage rescue team. Sounds good. My question at the time, I was talking with some pilots about it because our company was thinking about it, but they had to run it by the pilots union, and so the pilots were talking about it. I said, well, who's we? I found out, but later, after I studied 9/11, I found out. But my question was, who's we? Who can land that plane remotely? Well, the thing the pilots didn't like about this is that you lose all communication if you have this thing take over. It operates on the transponder frequency. And the transponder is what tells air traffic controllers who you are. Let's just say American Flight 11, that you're a 767, that you're traveling at X speed at such and such an altitude. And all of that shows up on their green radar screens through the transponder. But once the flight termination system takes over remotely to land you, that disappears. So you fall off radar. You disappear to the air traffic controllers. And that's what these planes did, according to the official story. And so when I looked at what the other flight attendant said, and the other flight attendant said that she, now Betty Ong was sitting at 3R, her jump seat, on the right-hand side in the aft part of the section of the aircraft, the very tail. Amy Sweeney called to a supervisor on her cell phone, and she said that again there was one hijacker and he was a he, and that he was seated in 9B. Well, flight attendants don't make mistakes like that. And later on, she called back and she said, "Oh, I made a mistake. It wasn't 9B. It was 10B who's the hijacker. 9B got stabbed. Something told me to look in to see who was 9B." And lo and behold, if 9B wasn't a highly trained assassin from a intelligence agency, he also was an anti-hijacking specialist, and he was, in fact, a hostage rescue specialist. He was one of the people that we would call, and they, once we land the aircraft, would help the passengers and the crew to safety, take the hijacker out. So that guy, the guy in 9B, he was a highly trained assassin. He was trained to kill people. His friends said about him that he could kill any human being using a pen and a credit card, and that he was quite the killer. And I thought to myself, well, now this is really interesting, because the official story would like you to believe that he was killed by some 5'6" Arab kids, and they were in their early 20s, that could barely speak English. But lucky for him, he also was fluent in Arabic. They were sitting in the row behind him, and just think about the last time you flew and overheard the people sitting behind you talking, because it's really easy to do, because they're sitting facing forward and their mouth is facing your ears, and you're about 18 to 24 inches away from their mouth. So it's really easy, and they're talking over the jets. It's really easy to overhear conversation. So I got to looking at this guy, and I thought, well, this is just impossible. He's a highly trained assassin. He could kill anybody. He was fluent in Arabic, and he was from a foreign government. He was from the Israeli Defense Forces Special Operations Unit called the Sayeret Matkal. So I thought, well, that's really interesting that he would be there. And how could it be possible that a flight attendant would tag him as a terrorist first, or the hijacker? It's just not a mistake we'd make, and I'll tell you why. If we were to make a mistake like that and tag you as the hijacker, and then we land that airplane and the hostage rescue team comes on, you're going to be dead, and you would be an innocent dead person. So we just wouldn't make that mistake. We'd have to be 150% sure before we told anybody who was the hijacker. So I saw all these anomalies, and then Amy Sweeney went on to say that, in fact, Betty Ong wasn't in her jumpsuit, but she was sitting in the second to the last row of coach seats with her. And then these two flight attendants are telling complete opposite stories. Betty Ong and Three Right, because she keeps telling the people on the phone in reservation she's at her jumpsuit in Three Right, she says that the guy that was stabbed in business class and the flight attendants, there's no doctor or nurse on board. That's really unusual too, but they had called for medical help and nobody was there. But Amy Sweeney, the other flight attendant, just sitting in the passenger seat, claiming that Betty was sitting there with her, she told an opposite story. She said the guy had been stabbed in 9B after she changed it from being the terrorist, and that a doctor and a nurse were tending him. Well, ways. There either is a doctor and a nurse on board tending him, or there isn't. So then I saw something very odd, is that both of the flight attendants were telling opposite stories. And so I started digging into all of the details of this, and I went down to the next flight. And on each of the first three flights on 9/11, we had two callers. On the first plane, there were two flight attendants. On the second plane, there were two passengers. So I looked at them, and at first, when I first looked at them, and I was writing and researching and wrote The Methodical Illusion, the first book, I hadn't looked this deep, and I was just as fooled as everyone else. One guy was a Gulf War a pilot, a hero. And I thought, well, that's sad. He fought in the Gulf War, and then he gets killed in this thing, right? And the other guy, he was traveling with his wife and a 3-year-old child, and they were, of course, no longer there. And they were going to Disneyland. Her first trip, by the way, to Disneyland. So I got my emotions were all wrapped up in those two people, too. After Methodical Illusion came out, I had some people share some information with me. And email and phone calls and Facebook, and became friends with lots of people that had lots of things to share. And lo and behold, that pilot really wasn't a pilot, but his pilot's wife contacted me on email. And she said Brian Sweeney was not a pilot. I said, well, the FBI document I have here says he's a pilot. She said, no, he was an RIO. He was a radar intercept officer. I said, oh, interesting. So I started looking into him. First, you need to know that I found something else. Inside the FAA headquarters, there were two companies that are government contract companies. One of them was called PTEC, and the other one was called MITRE, MITRE. For 2 years, they'd been in the FAA headquarters working on interagency compatibility so that NORAD and the FAA were seeing the same things. For 2 years, they were there. Okay, so I thought, well, that's really interesting that the FBI says this guy was a pilot and he ends up not being a pilot. That, well, I'm sure he could fly. He did train in Miramar. I did find that out. And in one of his obituaries, I found out that he was actually an employee at MITRE. And I thought, well, that's interesting. They were in the FAA headquarters for 2 years leading up to 9/11. So the next guy, and by the way, Brian Sweeney was sitting on the left side of the aircraft at row 31, which is very near the back of the airplane. Now, depending upon their seating structure, that plane probably had 32 or 33 seats, rows of seats. So he's sitting at 31, the left side of the aircraft. And then when I look and see what he says on his phone call, 3 minutes before they claim that plane hit the South Tower, I have the radar from the FAA, from a Freedom of Information Act draw of nearly a terabyte of information. And according to the government, that plane was 7,000 foot elevation, right over the Hudson River, between the Statue of Liberty and Newark International Airport. And he's sitting right there looking at Newark. And he tells his mother, who he calls at 9 o'clock, and tells her that he's on a plane that's been hijacked. And she asks him where they are, and he says, Ohio. And I thought, no, he's not even on this plane. The plane couldn't be there. How could he say that? And then off the right-hand side of the aircraft, on that same row, is Peter Hansen with his 3-year-old and wife. And he calls his father at 9 o'clock, 3 minutes before impact, 7,000 foot elevation over the Hudson. And when he looks out his window, he sees the Statue of Liberty, if he were on that plane, and that plane were there. He sees the Statue of Liberty right underneath him, and then Manhattan and skyline. And he tells his dad he thinks the hijackers, for some reason, now they barely spoke English, so I don't think they went back to row 31 and told him. So somebody had to have told Peter Hansen this. He thinks the hijacker is going to fly the airplane to Chicago and into a building. Okay, well, I wonder who told Peter Hansen that. Another thing that Brian Sweeney did over there on the left side, he told his mother that a group of passengers were thinking about taking over the cockpit from the hijackers. Well, that's the scenario from Flight 93. You remember they made a Hollywood movie out of it. And Todd Beamer's wife sold a book about it. Actually, three of the wives, at least, sold books about Flight 93, even though they weren't there. So I thought, well, that's really weird. I wonder how does he know that scenario? And what would make Peter Hansen, traveling with his wife and 3-year-old, think that the hijackers were going to fly them into a building in Chicago? It was almost as if someone had told him the scenarios of the day as it was supposed to unfold. Nothing hit Chicago, by the way, but something was supposed to. And the Sears Tower, the Willis Tower, was right after the Twin Towers were hit, was evacuated. Because they're actually, I believe, I'm finding a plane was actually supposed to look like it hit the Sears Tower as well. So, but some things started falling apart for these handlers. And by the way, so you know that there were not, I'm going to repeat that word, there were not 19 Arab hijackers on the real passenger manifests. There weren't any. So I know that if you watch Fox News, you're going to be being told that these guys are hijackers and they're terrorists and all of that stuff. You might be even starting to hate these people, but they were not on board the aircraft. But there were some handlers on board that worked for military industrial corporations like Raytheon, DynCorp, Rockwell Collins, MITRE, several companies like that. But there weren't any Arabs at all. And so these are the things that I found. And as I was looking through this, I started to go, uh-oh, this isn't at all what I thought took place on television. And it's actually really mind-blowing when I just took these planes one at a time. Well, I used to fly out of Boston. And so I knew that the phone calls from Flight 11 took place about 20 minutes after departure from Boston. So I started looking where could this plane be on the ground, because that lady's cell phone call to her supervisor had to have been made on the ground. The other gal, she said another thing that tipped me off. She said, "I don't know, but we might be being hijacked." Well, if you're a flight attendant or even a passenger and you're being hijacked, you know it. There's a hijacker. He's standing in the aisle. He's refusing to sit down and he's making demands. There's no question about it. You wouldn't be questioning it, and I wouldn't be as a flight attendant, but she was, which told me whatever was happening wasn't a typical hijacking, and both of the flight attendants referred to him as just one. Now, the official story says there were five of them, but there was just one, according to the two flight attendants, and their job is to give accurate information. They were giving inaccurate information, and they should never, ever, ever have sat on the phone for a half an hour. So I started to see, oh dear. Well, I got a Google Maps out, and I drew a circle to see where I might find an airport. And lo and behold, if I didn't find a reserve Air Force base with an 11,595-foot runway, which was more than enough runway to land these wide-body heavy jets full of fuel. And so I looked into that little reserve base. And after Methodical Illusion came out and people started hearing my interviews on Coast to Coast and Caravan to Midnight and several other radio stations or shows, they called me. They were based there. Their unit was activated on 9/11. And when they got there to the Air Force base to check in, because they'd been activated as a reserve unit, transport unit, they were told the base had been evacuated and that they were put up in hotels for 2 to 3 days. And they didn't know why until they heard me talk. Because one of the things that I found was this Air Force base was exactly the flight time for not just the phone calls that came out of Flight 11 and 175 from Boston, but also from the next flight from Dulles, which was Flight 77, a 757 that supposedly crashed into the Pentagon. And the minute that they landed, Barbara Olson, the CNN commentator, called her husband Ted Olson. Now, Ted Olson was the Solicitor General for the Department of Justice, and she was supposedly a conservative talk commentator from CNN. She was on Fox occasionally. And she calls her husband, and her husband that day runs to CNN and starts doing interviews, and his story changes. First, he says she called collect from a cell phone. And then he says, no, she called collect from one of those air phones. And then she called twice. So she called three times. She called four times. And then she called from her cell phone. I mean, it just changed. His story just changed. And so the problem with his story is that American Airlines had deactivated all of their air phones, the onboard telephones, on their 757s by January 31st of 2001. So he was lying about that. And as I discovered this, I'm thinking, well, what the heck? Well, interesting enough, I look into not just Barbara Olson, but her husband, Ted. And boy, do they have an interesting background. Barbara took a couple year degree from college in Texas, and then she went to Hollywood. Now, we know Hollywood's just steaming with conservatives, don't we? Liberal Hollywood. And she went to work at HBO. And we cannot find out what she did. She could have been an actress. She could have been doing commercials. There is no information on what she spent an entire decade doing in Hollywood, other than she worked for Stacy Keach Productions at HBO. There's nothing about her. And after she gathered enough money to go to school, she went to law school at a Jewish law school called Yeshiva University. And when she graduated from there, she ended up going into a Grab my notes here. She ended up going into a law firm in Washington, D.C., right out of school, right at the top of the pig pile in Washington. Now, listen carefully to what I'm going to tell you, because people have been asking me for a long time, was Barbara Olson part of this? I'm like, well, at first I didn't suspect anybody, but then after I saw that the guy that was traveling with his wife and 3-year-old actually knew the scenario about a building being hit in Chicago, which didn't happen but was supposed to, that and the other guy that thought he was in Ohio when he was right over the Hudson River, the Statue of Liberty in Newark International as a pilot, even a passenger would have known where they were. I started to get a little bit more suspicious about everyone that made these phone calls. So Barbara Olson gets a job right away with a company called a law firm called Wilmer Cutler and Pickering in Washington, D.C. Now, they've got some interesting history because one of their partners was the White House counsel for President Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton. And another one of their partners, he was the White House counsel for Vice President George H.W. Bush. And then when he became president, he was also the White House counsel, a White House attorney for the President George H.W. Bush. Now, there's another partner who served on the 9/11 commission, named Jamie Gorelick. There's another person that I found that has done most of the cover-up that was with the FBI, who also was in the same law firm that Barbara Olson was working at, and his name was Robert Mueller. At the time of 9/11, he was the head of the FBI. Now, there's another guy who was also with this law firm, and he was the governor of Massachusetts, William Weld. William Weld was the coach for George W. Bush, the younger Bush, when he went up against John Kerry in the debates, in the presidential debates. Now, Ted Olson, Barbara's husband, he was the attorney on the election when Bush and Gore were fighting over the hanging chads in Florida. So Ted Olson was Bush's attorney. He was also the attorney for the Israeli Mossad spy, Jonathan Pollard. And so I'm looking now at the clients of this law firm from Barbara Olson, and you can get to a point where you just stop believing in coincidences and you have to slap yourself across the face and face what you're looking at. And that's kind of what happened to me as I was going into this second book, because the methodical deception, you're going to learn about all the people and all the corporations. And if you're sitting there and you're looking at how badly everyone from the United States Air Force to the White House failed to keep America safe on 9/11, what happened to them? That's what I wanted. Did anybody lose their job? I would have, but I was kind of looking to see where did these people go and what were the companies that they were involved with. So here I am looking at the client list from Barbara Olson's law firm that she went to work for. And lo and behold, do you remember that highly trained assassin from 9B on Flight 11? Well, he owned a company called Akamai Technologies. He had gone through MIT, and Akamai Technologies is a kind of a multifaceted communications company, security, internet security, internet networking, telephone lines, and all of those things. And lo and behold, at the very top of this alphabetical list, the client list for Barbara Olson's law firm is Akamai Technologies. What are the chances that the guy that was the hostage rescue, paid a highly trained assassin sitting in 9B, who was fingered by the flight attendants as being the hijacker, would be a client of the law offices of Barbara Olson, who we are led to believe died crashing into the Pentagon? I was like, wow, now that's a coincidence. And so the next down the line in alphabetical order is another company from Israel, and it's called Amdocs. Amdocs was a company that monitored every single phone call for the decade leading up to 9/11 inside the United States of America. They did a lot of phone billing. And if you'll remember, before we all had cell phones, that if you were at your home and you were going to call Cleveland, it was going to cost you 12 or 18 cents a minute. And so there was somebody who was keeping track of that. It was Amdocs. They kept track of every single phone call made inside the United States, any kind of phone. So I thought, well, that's kind of an interesting connection too. They also represented a company called AT&T and Avid Technologies. Now, this is a really interesting because remember when I first saw the plane slide right into that building like a hot knife through butter, I thought it was trick photography. So this next company, this is really interesting. It's called Avid Technologies. And if you work at all with video or audio, you probably know this company. They do audio and video production technology, including their specialty, which is called digital nonlinear editing. Now, I'm going to bring this right home with you because I don't know if they do this at the BYU games. I don't watch college games much. But in the NFL football games, several years back, we started to see the line of scrimmage show up as a bright orange line. And you started to see the logos and an arrow pointing to, so you could look at the screen and say, okay, that's the Dallas Cowboys and they're going that direction. And then those things disappear. When you're in a stadium, you don't see those. That is live nonlinear editing. So that if, let's just say, a Tomahawk missile were flying through the sky and was going to hit the South Tower, through this technology, they could make that look just like a 767. Sorry, I think I lost my one of my pages here. Sorry. So I thought I lost my internet connection there. So I thought, well, now that's really, really interesting that they this same law firm with the what we thought was a victim, Barbara Olson, is really in bed with all of these companies. I'm like, wow. Well, you remember Building 7? That building fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon, having not been hit by any aircraft debris or any aircraft. Well, inside that building, not only was it the largest CIA operation this side of Langley, Virginia, but there was evidence in there for some really big trials coming up. If you're old enough to remember Enron and another company called WorldCom, they had both hired this same law firm that Barbara Olson worked for to sort of come in and pretend to do an investigation. And so I thought, well, isn't that interesting? Because every bit of evidence from those two trials, and by the way, they were going to trial in October of 2001. All of that stuff has disappeared, gone forever. And so they just sort of went through the trials without evidence. So, as you see what I started to see here, that there's something really wrong going on here with Barbara Olson and Ted Olson and this connection to the Israeli Mossad. And then we've got this assassin who we're supposed to believe was killed with the black plastic box cutter. Now, there are pictures of the evidence. They claim they got the only thing that they got out of the ditch in Shanksville, no titanium engines, no landing gear, no luggage, just one Saudi Arabian passport and a plastic. And these are, I know you know these, if you go to Lowe's Hardware or something, they are yellow and they're about a half inch wide and about 5 inches long. They kind of look like the old carpenter's pencil. And so, let's see, I'm getting a message here. Not much bigger than that. And the blade that comes out of there is just about a quarter of an inch, and it's got a little serration. So you couldn't even cut through a chicken with that, let alone behead a flight attendant or a highly trained assassin. Or I found a document in the Freedom of Information Act data. Now I have a terabyte of information from the government. And this is all government documents. I've got stuff even from Hill Air Force Base in Utah, from the United States Air Force. And this is an article, a report actually, that's dated September 13th of 2001. And the Air Force claimed that the plane that went into Shanksville was a 747. It was actually a 757, which is about a third of the size of a 747. And when I first saw that, I thought, well, they must have made a typing mistake here and hit the four instead of the five. But that's actually in the report at least three or four times in the paragraph part, not just in a chart. So it wasn't a type error. And I don't know how to explain that the United States Air Force there in Hill Air Force Base would think that Flight 93 that sunk into that ditch in Shanksville was a 747, but they did. Maybe there was a war game drill going on and it was supposed to be a 747 involved. I don't know because it makes no sense at all, but I do have the report. And actually, it's in the Methodical Deception book in the appendix. So what I found was that there was a lot of hocus pocus going on by all of these organizations involved with our government. And basically, I hate to use this word, but it's the only one that fits, cover up. And then I just discovered that Barbara Olson's, one of the partners in that law firm, was the eventually came on to be the head of the FBI at the time of 9/11, and that they also represented 9B, the trained assassin from Israel Defense Forces, Sayeret Matkal. I stopped believing in all coincidences at that moment. And then I started to really look into this stuff. And when I teach the reader how to do this in the first book, Methodical Illusion. You can check my work. When I first discovered the Air Force Base, I thought, well, that takes care of those flights out of Boston, and it works. And that's probably where they were taken. And see, I have now, since that book came out, I have the Freedom of Information Act. I have all the radar that the FAA claims, I'm going to use that word real loudly, claims that the planes flew. Because there's a problem with that. But we'll talk about that later. So I've, you know, followed these planes, and I have the flight plan that they filed before they left Boston. And I thought, okay, well, that works. And then let me check flight 77. And in this flight calculator that I take you to in one of the chapters in that book, the Methodical Illusion, the flight from D.C., to this Air Force Base is exactly the time that the phone calls start. Now, Barbara Olson made this phone call, and she's the only person to say that the hijackers used knives and box cutters as their weapons. Now, on Flight 93, they said they had a bomb, they had a gun, and they had box cutters on Flight 93. So then I found an FAA document that said that on flight 11 at 8:44, 2 minutes before it hit the North Tower, that someone was shot. So we've got guns, pepper spray, mace, knives, box cutters, and all of these weapons that were allowed to be brought on board four aircraft out of three airports on 9/11. And of course, being a flight attendant, I had to look. I had to look and see, well, who was running security? Because at that time, we didn't have a TSA, you'll remember. We had hired private companies. And so lo and behold, I find this company, that, and I knew them well because they handled most of the security in the country. It was called Huntley USA, and it's a subsidiary of ICTS International. And they run all the security for United, American, all the security at Boston Logan, Newark International, and Dulles. Wow. I was like, wow. And they let on bombs and knives and all pepper spray and mace. All of those things, by the way, on 9/11 were illegal to have on board. So if anyone went through a magnetometer and went through security, those things should have been found. They should have been removed. And so according to the official story, these weapons were allowed to be brought on. So I just did a little Google search into ICTS International and Huntley USA. And what I found absolutely blew me away. This is a company that was started by a convict in Israel. A convict. He was convicted of campaign finance fraud and falsifying documents and some other thing. Three or four counts of things that landed him in prison. So since he was in prison, everyone in the United States decided, well, let's use them for security. So they were running security at almost every major airport in this country, probably even your airport there in Salt Lake. That's your closest airport. I'm not kidding you. We hired a company that was started by a man who was in prison in Israel to run security, and so did American and United. And lots of other places too. This was a big security company. As a matter of fact, ICTS International, the parent company, still to this day runs security in Charles de Gaulle Airport, Amsterdam, most Paris, everywhere, and throughout the European Union. Now, speaking of Charles de Gaulle, you all remember Richard Reid. He was the tennis shoe bomber. Well, ICTS International allowed him on board. And so after that, we had to start taking our shoes off. And then a few years later, they ran also the security at Amsterdam Schiphol Airport, and they allowed Abdulmutallab, the panty bomber who almost destroyed a Northwest airplane, coming into Detroit on Christmas Day. Same company. So they failed in Paris, they failed in Amsterdam, they failed in Dulles, Boston, and Newark on 9/11. And what the heck am I looking at now? Well, one of the things I like to do, and I research people and companies, is I click on Board of Directors. So I'm looking at ICTS International, and lo and behold, if the former Secretary of Transportation for the United States government, Norman Mineta, is sitting on the board of this company that failed United, failed American, failed in Boston Logan, failed in Paris, failed in Amsterdam, failed in Newark, and failed in Washington, D.C. Now, would any of you in that audience there go put yourself on the board of directors for a company that failed your country that badly, that was started by a convict in Israel? This makes no sense, does it? I mean, you just have to start using your logic when you're looking at this, and it just doesn't make any sense. So I keep looking at some of the other people that were involved, and I found something really interesting. That it was very obvious there were no cameras in Boston Logan Airport. That's why we don't know who was on the planes, and we don't know if there were hijackers or not. And we'll never know, because you're being lied to. And you're being brainwashed to think that this was done by 19 Arabs. And I'm here to tell you today, there were not 19 Arabs. There weren't any Arabs on those planes. And coincidentally, there were a lot of people that were government contractors, and there were at least two Israeli Defense Forces people that I've found, at least two. So we have these people that are making these phone calls, and I'm not even sure if some of them were on the planes. They may not even have been on the planes in the hangars, because they were so messed up with the scenario of the day, they couldn't follow their assignment. It's like Brian Sweeney claiming that they were going to take over the cockpit. I'm here to tell you, as a flight attendant, we train for hijacking and we have a protocol set. One of the words we used was methodical, and this is how I would use it. We were to be, if there were a hijacker in the cabin, we were to be very formal. So I would say, Captain Campbell, this is Miss Roth. I'm being methodical. This is a horribly long trip. And in those code words, methodical and trip, he would reach over to the radio frequency and tap in 7500. That frequency would tell everyone, our company, people on the ground, air traffic control, other planes in the area, that we have a hijacker on board our aircraft. That didn't happen. And it didn't happen for a reason. Because there was no hijacker on board the airplane. There were handlers, and I believe that most of them had guns. So it's a whole different scenario what happened. As I continue to look at the people that made the phone calls, now remember the movie Flight 93, what Hollywood did right away. They actually did this right away. And the wives who supposedly lost their husbands, they all got big book contracts with big publishers in New York to promote this story. Even though they weren't there, they didn't know. Some of them hadn't even talked to their husband. Todd Beamer, he'd just been in Israel 2 weeks before, and then he'd been in Rome for a week with his wife. He didn't want to talk to her. He wanted to talk to the GTE operator because I don't know, he couldn't connect. And when he called the operator, she said, "I'll connect you to your wife." He said, "No, I don't know why." Maybe she could tell he was lying. Who knows? But it was very odd that what I found out by looking at these guys as I was gathering more information for the second book is that they all of the guys that we are led to believe, I was in your same camp, so they were all 6 foot 1 to 6 foot 4, and they all played rugby. Some of them played quarterback for their college football team. They were 30-ish, 30, 31, 32, 33. One of them, not only did he play rugby, who was the captain of the rugby team, he also was a champion in judo. But lo and behold, one of them who called his mother and said, "Mom, this is Mark Bingham," using his first and last name. "You do believe me?" She said, "We've been hijacked." And his mother was actually a retired flight attendant. He said, "You do believe me, don't you, Mom?" Well, he ran a public relations company, and he had just fought off in the San Francisco Bay Area an armed mugger that had a gun on him. Now, this guy was, 6'2", 225 pounds, and a rugby player. He'd fought off a mugger. Yet on this day on Flight 93, all of those guys who all of their friends, and you can read their obituaries, everything I found was available in public knowledge online. And much like Brian Sweeney, whose friends said from Miramar in San Diego that he could kill any human with his bare hands, all of Mark Bingham's coworkers were amazed because he could, really kick butt on people, even if they carried a gun, he took them down. So we have these people. Their friends said they were aggressive and take charge. They were competitive. They were athletic as heck. They were all still playing very competitive sports like rugby. And yet on 9/11, we're led to believe they sat in four different rows on four different phone calls to four different people. And then all of a sudden, Todd Beamer decides to say, "Let's roll and go." Well, at the time, according to the National Transportation Safety Board, that airplane had gone from 42,000 feet down to 19,000 feet and was headed down from 19,000 feet at 6 to 10,000 feet per minute. This is the last 3 minutes of their flight. They decided to take a beverage cart or meal cart with some pots of hot water on top and crash through the cockpit door. That was what they were going to do, according to the official story. That's what our heroes, Let's Roll, did on Flight 93. The problem with that is the aircraft was coming not only out of the sky, 6 to 10,000 feet. That's a very rapid emergency descent. The airplane would not be something you could stand up in. You definitely wouldn't want to unlock a cart and put it in. The 757 aisle is about 25 inches wide, and the carts are about 24 inches wide. And if you've ever traveled on one, you'll remember that's that cart you can't get by when you got to go to the bathroom. That won't let you go through. You can't scooch in there like on the Airbus. There's no room for you to scooch by. You have to wait till we push it back and forth so that you can get into the aisle. That's how narrow that is with both of the beverage and meal carts. So I'm looking at this from a flight attendant's position, and I'm thinking, oh, well, 40-degree angle. Come on, 40 degrees, 6,000 to 10,000 feet a minute. You're fighting some G forces. You're not pulling a cart out, and you're not running down the aisles with coffee pots either. And then, lo and behold, according to the FAA and the National Transportation Board, at the time they're going to do this, the plane is upside down in the sky. I am not kidding you. It is upside down. So, do you believe that story now? I can't. I mean, you couldn't do that if the plane was coming out of the sky 6,000 feet a minute. Or 10,000 feet a minute, let alone at a 40-degree angle, let alone upside down. It's strictly impossible for anyone to believe. But here's what happened to us all collectively. We saw something so horrible. We saw people jumping out of towers. We saw planes doing what they can't do, dissolving into buildings and into the ground and into the Pentagon. We were in so much shock and awe, was the term they used when they took Baghdad. We were all collectively so blown away that we were easily brainwashed to think that 19 Arab Muslims did this. And that's why you'll see on the media, they keep repeating that. But it's not true at all. But in fact, what is true is very much more horrifying than what we thought we saw. And that's what I actually have unfolded in the methodical deception. So the methodical illusion, I wanted to find the planes, the passengers, and the crew members, and I did. And I explained to you how to do it, and I explain what the wake-up process is, because I didn't want to wake up. I didn't want to look. I was in cognitive dissonance. I was afraid to find out that my government did this, or that they turned their head, or that they're covering it up, which is what I found. I didn't want to look there. I wanted to be an American. I wanted to be proud of my flag and my country and all my fellow countrymen and all the servicemen and all of that, just like you guys probably did. So what happened to me then, as after Methodical Illusion came out, I had a woman contact me. She was from Western Massachusetts. And I'm going to read to you, it's a sworn statement from an affidavit she's given me, and it's in my safe. And this is in the Methodical Deception now. But this is really amazing, because for 14 years, this woman thought that she was going insane because what she saw. And I'm going to read the statement, and I'm going to tell you a little bit of my conversation with her. And this is just one example of the people, like the people that were based there at Westover Air Force Base and that were locked out and told me the base had been evacuated. She says, "My name is Sarah Swain." This is not her real name. This is for the book. "And I was living in Otis, Massachusetts on September 11, 2001. At approximately 8:30 to 8:35, I saw a United Airlines plane fly over my residence at the time, and I was shocked because the plane was very low. I could see people in the windows. I was standing on the deck on the second floor, and I was watching the plane fly over the top of the house, and I lost track of it because of the way the building was, but I do think it was going north when it flew over the house and after I lost sight of it. I was speaking with my neighbor, and we were just amazed at the height of the plane. It was so low. I shouldn't say height. I should say altitude. It was so low, we were flabbergasted. Now I know that it was approximately 8:30. I would say no later than 8:45. Because I had to go to an appointment in the next town over and be there by 9:30. And I left maybe 5 minutes after I saw the plane, and I headed to the next town, which was Great Barrington. This is in Western Massachusetts, due west of Westover Air Force Base, where all four of those planes were taken by remote control." Now, that is in a sworn affidavit. She's willing to go to court. I have military people who were based there, activated and locked out, and never knew why. And now we have a civilian. But let me tell you something else I found that was just way beyond coincidence. The woman who was in charge of the FAA administration at the time, a lady named Jane Garvey. Well, Jane Garvey's from Western Massachusetts. And her husband, at the time of 9/11 and still to this very day, is the sheriff of the county that surrounds the west, northwest, and north end of Westover Air Force Base. So if my friend who contacted me to tell me this story for my that I ended up putting in this book for you, so you know the truth, had called 911, there's chances that she could have been silenced or just ignored, and that her story would never, ever have been told. Now, she told me, when she contacted me, "You have vindicated the last 14 years. My friends and family and coworkers all told me I was crazy because what she saw." Now think about this. The next time you're near an airport, look at how low an airplane has to be to see a face in a window. It's pretty close. Now the 767 is a wide body airplane. It's big, kind of like a DC-10, L-10-11. I mean, it's a pretty big wide body aircraft with two aisles inside. So, you know, the fuselage is pretty good size. Windows are all pretty standard. But she said when she got out of the appointment, she was certain she was going to hear that a plane had crashed just north of Otis, Massachusetts. Now, this is not Otis, the Air Force Base that's south of Boston. This is Otis, Massachusetts, due west of Westover, and is due west of Boston as well, almost straight line. So Westover is about 79 miles, and she's like 24 miles away. So very, very close, and they easily could have gone. And I had tracked the radar from Flight 175. It took a southerly course, and it was just south of Westover when they lost their transponder, which means the flight termination system had taken over. So I knew when she called me that that plane had veered north and it would have gone right over her town. And so when I'm talking to her, I didn't know Otis was even a town. It's a small town. There's a turkey farm there. And I grabbed my Google map and I was looking, and she said it was 8:30, 8:35, maybe 8:40 at the most, you know, 8:45 at the very most, because she had to leave to be on time for her appointment. And I absolutely, my heart sunk, because this was the second reconfirmation and a civilian eyewitness that was willing to put this in a signed affidavit and go to court about it. So there's no doubt this is not a theory. It's not a conspiracy theory. But what I realized is that so many of the people and the corporations involved in 9/11 were also involved in the wars that were planned by the Project for New American Century, which was written and planned to have a new Pearl Harbor to rally the American people for the seven pre-planned wars that were planned long before 9/11 took place. And that's all, everything I'm telling you, you can just Google search. So it's all out there. It's all public knowledge. I just put it all together. Now, there's a lot more that I put together, but I would like to just stop and see if any of you have any questions that you would like to funnel in my direction. And my publisher, I think Mike showed up there, I hope. And if you are interested in autographed books, you can get those from him while you're there. And I'm happy to answer some questions if you have some. All right. Well, let me just take these one at a time for you, because these are all great questions. Someone asked about cell phones and why they don't work at altitude, and why they don't, and at what altitude do they work? Well, at the time of 9/11, we had phones that didn't hardly work on the ground inside an airplane, because it acts a bit like a Faraday cage. And so there's all this aluminum metal around. Now, if you know about a Faraday cage, you can understand what I'm talking about. So there are times on the 757, I was standing in the back galley with flight attendants, and we would be holding our little Nokia, those little flat phones that were, you know, kind of about the size of four giant packs of gum or something, all one segment. And we would be saying, how many bars do you have? Do you have any reception? I have T-Mobile, or I have AT&T, I have Sprint. And we were comparing, and a lot of us didn't have any on the ground inside the aluminum aircraft. So the technology at the time of 9/11, still the same. There are cell towers. This is why they don't work. Because once you get above about 1,800, maybe as high as 3,000, if the, everything were just right, you might be able to make a five-second phone call. But because the airplane, because the cell phone works on towers, and the airplane starts going really fast, at cruise altitude, we go nearly 500 miles an hour. So you're going pretty fast. You're too fast to connect with those towers and stay connected. So that's why they don't work. And the altitude that you usually, even about 4 years ago I flew, it was the last time I probably will, and I tested my cell phone about 4 years ago on a flight, and around 1,800 feet, both going up and landing, I lost cell reception. I mean, I didn't have any cell reception until I got below 1,800 feet. So that's why I knew, and every flight attendant and pilot will tell you, that on 9/11, nobody was making cell phone calls unless they were on the ground. So somebody asked, what's a purser? And that's a great question. A purser is a flight attendant, kind of like deluxe, with the lettuce and tomato and onion on top. We are the ones, we have a special training, and we're trained in psychology and passenger handling and conflict resolution and that kind of stuff. And we're that person at the door that you show your ticket to on usually international flights. Now, some airlines have pursers that do fly domestic, but pursers are usually on international flights. We do all the cargo manifests, the passenger manifests, and we're the one that'll come around if you're going from here to Paris, and before we land, make sure that you've filled out your immigrations, customs forms, and that you have indeed got your passport and all of those forms ready. And so we'll be that person. If you have problems, if you're having a flight attendant that's not serving you, and the problem is with service, you would come up to the first class section and talk to the purser. It's basically the flight attendant in charge. So next question here, the flight termination system. Well, as I told you, the flight termination system is how we fly drones from little they look kind of like game consoles and Creech Air Force Base, and the drone itself is in Afghanistan or Pakistan or Yemen, somewhere like that, on the other side of the world. And the flight termination system itself, actually, this remote control of aircraft has been around since the 70s. And so this was not new technology at all. They just decided, now we hadn't had a hijacking since the 70s, DB Cooper. So for some reason in the 90s, but this 9/11 event was in the planning for many, many years. And so they decided they would sell this to some carriers, and not every carrier bought them. American Airlines referred to theirs as the flight interruption system. But it basically worked the same way. And it was basically sold, and this is why the pilots wouldn't have guessed that this was activated, because it was sold in the event of a hijacker being inside the cockpit, and there wasn't one on 9/11. So they would never have dreamed that this thing had taken over. They more than likely thought they were having a mechanical delay. And here's what happened on Flight 11. It was up for 9 minutes, it got to around 18,000 feet. The flight termination system took over, and in 8 minutes, they were on the ground at Westover Air Force Base. So, real quick, that's pretty fast. The pilots are realizing that the aircraft is no longer climbing to cruise altitude. They don't know why. They're thinking they're having some sort of mechanical. They're busy trying to fix it. The flight attendants can't call because the flight termination system has taken over, and the system, there is no communication with the cockpit. So, I'm sure until they saw an Air Force base in front of them, they had no idea. And now, since the methodical illusion came out, I've met with lots of flight attendants. And it's kind of fun because the senior ones, they remember that methodical code word. And so we have put our heads together, and what we think happened, because you see, flight attendants and pilots put your safety as our top priority. So when we put our uniforms on, it's basically we will lay our lives down for our passengers. So, and I think you just saw that in the British airplane that just caught on fire in Las Vegas the other day. Now, those flight attendants acted quick. The plane was on fire, and they blew those chutes open and got those people out of there in less than 3 minutes' time. And they were walking away from that airplane before a bigger disaster happened. These are the things we train for. And the next thing someone asked was about how often do we train, and about the hijack protocols. We train every year. And we train for a full day. Every flight attendant across the United States has to certify to be a flight attendant every year. And so you have, when you get out of training, they give you a month. Let's say your month is June. Sometime in there, amongst your flight hours, you have to put in your training hours. And that training is a full 8 to 5 day. And then before you get there, you have to work a workbook that is supposed to take 8 to 10 hours to just go over everything. In the hijack protocols, one, if you're not the person the hijacker is directly dealing with, you were to sit down and not draw attention to yourself and basically abandon the hijacker with one flight attendant that then would be handling everything that person was demanding. So there was one thing. And by not drawing attention to yourself would be not making phone calls and sitting with a telephone to your ear for a half an hour. That was so abnormal to me. I just couldn't get over that flight attendants would make phone calls like that. It's just not right. On Flight 93, the flight attendants that called, Cece Lyles, she called out, and you can listen to this on Wikipedia. She called out and she left a message on her home phone. Now, she'd been a police officer for 6 years and a flight attendant for 1 year, so she had lots of training in self-defense and that. But right before crash time, she called and left a message for her husband about 15 minutes before the crash and Flight 93 into Shanksville, supposedly. And she said this very heart-wrenching goodbye, and she knew that she was never going to see him again, to her children and her husband. And she leaves the phone. Whether it's a cell phone or a receiver, but you can hear her. You know, when somebody hands a receiver to someone, you can hear that. It's kind of like when I'm doing this on my microphone. You can hear that sound, and she hands the phone to someone, and a woman's voice says to Cece Lyles, "You did great." Now, this is 15 minutes before impact, Flight 93. To a flight attendant, a woman passenger is telling her she did great by saying goodbye to her husband and children. Now, the interesting thing is if you compare the people that were on the phone to what the National Transportation Board and the FAA claimed the aircraft was doing, it's impossible. Because of the G-forces, you wouldn't even be holding a phone. And no woman is going to be sitting next to a flight attendant commending her for saying goodbye to her husband and children. I guarantee you that. But there was obviously a woman there in the hangar that gave her the kudos for doing such a great job. So the protocols that we had, the pilots would, once they found out, like I said, Captain Campbell, we'd be very formal, which we usually weren't. We'd be extremely more formal, so he would recognize it. Mr. Captain, this is Rebecca Roth, Miss Rebecca Roth, and I'm being methodical. That code word, methodical, told him, uh-oh, we got a hijacker. And I would say to him, this is a very long trip. And those two words, trip and methodical, would tell him, I've got a hijacker here who wants in the cockpit. And I'm going to do everything I can to keep him out. And then he would reach over, hit the squawk, the 7500 on the radio, and that transponder then would kick out and tell everyone that needed to know that this aircraft was being hijacked, and there was a hijacker in the cabin. So that's kind of how that worked. And then just there were some other things to do. Basically, our job was to prevent the hijacker from getting inside the cockpit, to keep the pilots safe so the pilots get the plane on the ground, because getting the plane on the ground was our top priority in a hijacking. And then someone else, why are they letting me speak? Why am I not dead? You know, I get asked this almost every interview now. It's just weird. I don't know. You know, I wrote my books as a novel to give me a little bit of leeway to reality. Some plausible deniability, I guess, as a novel. But we know that some people that write novels are murdered. But if they murder me, take me out of the drone or murder me, well, I guess you'll know that everything I wrote in those two books is 100% true and a very big threat to the military-industrial complex and the New World Order. So and the next question somebody asked me was about Israel, that they had, they were aware that Israel was involved. The Israeli Mossad is very different than the Israeli people. This is like, we're as different, you and me are as different from the CIA as the Jewish people in Israel are from the Mossad. It's a very different organization. And if you understand politics and war and the war machine, and if you're old enough to remember when John F. Kennedy was killed, they often referred to that later on, and as people started to look into who did it, as the military-industrial complex. And these would be the people that signed the Project for a New American Century. These are people, and by the way, if you used to be a Republican, just so you know, Jeb Bush is a signer of the Project for New American Century. And if you listen very carefully to Marco Rubio, he is using the term New American Century right out of the mark. So I'm scrolling up to look at the other questions there. But yes, the Mossad was involved. I go very much in depth into putting all of this together in the methodical deception. I suggest you read the methodical illusion first, because I follow, this is truly a sequel. And the methodical illusion will help you. And the reason I wrote this book was to help wake people up. So if you guys out there are all awake, and you know people like your neighbors or people in your church or your ward or your family that aren't awake, this is a great book, Methodical Illusion, to give to them unsuspecting and let them wake up with Vera Hansen. Because Vera Hansen, the main protagonist, one of the things she does, actually, she flies to Salt Lake City and she meets a character who is very much a real person in real life, fashioned after Stephen Jones, who is a professor at Brigham Young University. And his name in the book is Jonah Stevens. And you'll recognize him from his boyish grin, because I just fashioned his character after all the YouTubes I saw of him and his mannerisms and that boyish grin. So he tells Vera that in the dust, by the way, the FBI's never looked at the dust, so they can't tell you whether it's radioactive or whether there was nanothermite or thermite or other explosives found in it, because the FBI has never been compelled to put that through their lab for some reason. But when some people did it, like Professor Stephen Jones, they kind of got in a little problem with their work arrangement. And a lot of people have lost their jobs by looking at what really happened. He would be one of those people. The truth right now, it is just amazing when you start talking the truth, what happens to you. I mean, I see it on YouTube, and when I do interviews and stuff, some people, they just can't handle this. And it's a very difficult thing. I mean, some of the stuff that I'm doing now is working with people that did read Methodical Illusion and have just realized that their inkling, every one of us has, especially as women, we have this intuition, we have this feeling, and you have this discernment, and you know when you're being lied to. And so a lot of people come to me and say, well, I always knew there was no plane crash at Shanksville and the Pentagon. And then they read this book, and they put all of the corporations, all the players, all the phone callers, all of these people together, the way it's laid out, and they listen to the interviews, and they just like, oh my goodness, it's like, how come I didn't see that? I actually have a lot of airline pilots that say, well, how did you put all this together? Because it's perfectly clear when you do. And this is how I did it. I went into this without any religious or without any preconceived notion, with the exception that I thought that it was 19 Arab Muslims that did this. And I had to prove that wrong, I guess. I mean, I kept running into the same people from the Middle East that are supposed to be our best friends and that were involved in this. Now, in the methodical deception, I've actually got proof in there, in the appendix, and that the flight radar that I am privileged to have, and I'm happy to share it, was uploaded to a computer before takeoff in the FAA. Now, you remember me telling you that MITRE and PTEC were actually working in the FAA headquarters for 2 years leading up to 9/11 on interagency compatibility. Well, another interesting thing I found in the meta tags on the text files that the radar is in, it's in text files of numbers, latitude, longitude, locations, and transponders, and all kinds of numbers in these text documents, that when you save a document to a computer, sometimes we forget, and someone did, that it's meta tagged with the time, the hour, the minute, the second, and the day, the month, and the year. And so one of the things I found was a WAV file. This is in the Freedom of Information Act data. And the WAV file is marked terrorist. And before September 13th, 2001, the word terrorist was never used in aviation. It was a hijacker. It would never have been terrorist. And much to my surprise, that particular WAV file that's got a terrorist voice saying, we have some planes, we are going back to the airport, that file was uploaded to the FAA computer system at 6:37 a.m. on 9/11/2001, before the airplanes pushed back from the gate. The first aircraft left at 8 a.m. So somebody's got some explaining to do. And if I thought I was going to be a drone strike after Methodical Illusion, look out now, because this is the real corker. Now, I've got an eyewitness who saw Flight 175, and I've got meta tags on radar files. And the thing that's interesting about the radar files that I have is that they are only for 8:30-ish, I'm going to say, 2 minutes before, 2 minutes after, until impact. And I'm missing 16 minutes of time for those two flights out of Boston. And it's because those flights left late. And so, in order to make a fake flight path, they had to choose the time that fit the closest. And then, so we have missing data, which we means we have an airplane that's not anywhere on any radar at all. And the thing that, well, I discovered this in a fluke, but the thing that surprised me is I have NORAD data. And this is coming out of Hill Air Force Base, 84 Raids, it's called. They did in NORAD's radar. The location and the altitude for all four airplanes are different in 5 to 10,000 feet in elevation in altitude and 35 to 50 feet on the map. And so I kept looking at this. I was driving my husband crazy, I'm sure, because I spent hours and hours looking at this, and I'm thinking, well, now if I'm in my GPS in my car and it tells me I'm in one particular town, I can't be in the town 25 miles or 35 miles or 50 miles away. I'm only in one place, just like the airplanes should be. And so that was kind of a red flag to me that the FAA and the NORAD were showing me different altitudes and different locations. And so there's a reason why there's a reason why all these questions cannot be answered by the government, and there's a reason why nobody's looking. But one of the things I found that I bring out in the next book, the second book there, The Methodical Deception, is the Israeli spy ring. And at the time of 9/11, around 240 Israeli spies were rounded up. There was a group of Israeli art students that were actually living in the 91st floor of the World Trade Center Tower. So when you go to my website, you might want to take note of this. It's www.methodicaldeception.com. And you click on the resource page. If you click on the top left box, it says for information about Israeli art students at WTC, click here. You will go back into a page with some pictures of these Israeli art students. They were bomb explosive specialists from the Mossad. They were part of an art group called Gelatin, as in blasting gelatin. It's called gelignite. And in the boxes, in those pictures behind those art student Israeli bomb experts, you'll see these numbers on a box, and it's called BB-18. It's big bold letters. You can't miss them. I mean, it's right there. Well, I followed what that BB-18 goes to, and it goes to a company called Lytell Fuse Company. And those are electrical fuse holders that can be used. Now, come on, we know the towers had electricity because they'd been built in the early 70s. So, and they were also built to withstand a couple 707s, which were very much like a 757, hitting them. So they were built to take that, but they didn't. So these Lytell fuses, I started to look deep into that. And if you've listened to some of the interviews I've done lately, I know we're kind of short on time. But I dug through that, and it relates to a company called Trecor, and they relate to a company called Kellex, which was Kellogg's, and it was a uranium refining by the Kellogg company. I know you think of cereal when you think of Kellogg, but you can look all this up online, and you will know that company is KBR, and they were also a spinoff from Halliburton, or Halliburton spun off from them. One of the things I've found is these large military industrial corporations, they hire the same people. A lot of them come out of the military and out of the, for instance, you know, the head of the FAA sitting on the board of directors for MITRE. And so a lot of these people come out of, like, they're retired generals, and they'll go into MITRE, or they'll go into DynCorp, and they'll go into companies like that. And they go back and forth, and then they change their name, and they merge. And oh, okay, I was saying, you guys are reading something. So they merge, and they hire each other, and then they have a merger, and these huge, gigantic, multi-million, billion-dollar transactions take place back and forth. So when you dig down and look at what I've been looking at, you almost have to chart it, because you have to keep track of everyone, because it's just a card trick. It's like that shell game where You don't know who's on the board of directors for who, and they're all related, and it just happens over and over again. And like I said, I started to find so many people really involved and connected. Like the passenger in 9B is connected to Barbara Olson, who's connected to George Bush, who's connected to, I mean, it's just ridiculous how it goes. So after a while, you have to slap yourself across the face and wake up to the reality is that this was a false flag event and that we've been lied to. Why are they letting me tell the time? I was just kind of scrolling through and looking for any more questions here. Listen to my interviews. Yeah, Israel was involved. What happened to the passengers at the Air Force Base? That's a great question, and I only can surmise. But you know how the cabal, they like to give you kind of a heads up and they like to tell you stuff? Well, almost everybody that called said there was pepper spray or mace used in the cabin. Now, Peter Hansen, he said the people sitting around him were vomiting and getting sick, but he wasn't. He was just talking to his dad as everything was normal, telling his dad they were going to fly to Chicago and fly him into a building. But for some reason, all the people around him were puking, but he wasn't. He wasn't even coughing. So I think what happened is each aircraft that was landed, the first three airplanes, two people made phone calls. The flight attendants on flight 11, Peter Hansen and Brian Sweeney, the two guys that were involved with those military industrial corporations off flight 175. Barbara Olson and a junior flight attendant named Renee May. She also called her mom and dad. That would be the last thing you would do if you made a phone call in a hijacking because they don't know what to do. But you have phone numbers accessible to yourself as a flight attendant that would be people involved with your company that could quickly call the FAA. So that was not protocol. And then on flight 93, when it finally rolled in, all the handlers from the other flights were free, and they actually used about 11 people. Four of them were the heroes, the rugby players. I'm not even sure if those guys were really anywhere near that Air Force Base today, to tell you the truth. It's quite possible that Barbara Olson and some of the other phone callers were not even at the airport or at the planes, even. And they may not even have been at the Air Force Base. Because they sure didn't know where they were, and there's no real explanation for that, other than maybe they weren't there. And it was a charade, and they didn't know where they were supposed to be. So when the reservation agent asked Betty Ong, she had to ask her about six times, "What seat are you in?" And Betty didn't know what to tell her. So finally, she broke down and she pretended like she wasn't hearing it because she was avoiding answering the question. Finally, she said she was in her jump seat at 3R. But her coworker said she was in the last row of coach seats with her. So, you know, how do you explain that? Flight attendants in a hijacking, the most important thing, if you were giving any information, normally it would be given to the pilots, pilots to the ground. So the important thing would be the hostage rescue people, they would be telling the captain something like this: at 5:05, we will be coming through the back door on the right side, which would have been her door. She's sitting in a jump seat, they fold down from the wall. You've all seen them. And if that door pops in open, she'll break her knees, or she could be shot or, you know, really injured. So they don't want her barricading that door they're going to come in, and she'd want to make sure that that door was not armed with a chute. And so they would be coordinating that, the pilots to the hostage rescue team on the ground to the flight attendants in the back. But in this case, nobody could talk to anyone. So that's one reason why a lot of the airline pilots did not want, and we did not get the flight termination system put on board our aircraft. Because of that communication in a hijacking is so vital that it means life and death to our passengers. So nobody wanted to lose that. So that's what happened. So let's see, those who perpetrated this crime still control the government. What comes next? Okay, well, this is kind of scary. I actually found something. It's in the Methodical Illusion. It was a five or six city plan that the Israeli newspaper Ynet News said that the Israeli intelligence, now these are the Mossad, these are the people that were the bomb experts living in the towers, these were the traveling art students, these are the people that got picked up by the United States government and put on an LL aircraft the next day and sent home to safety where they can never be extradited to the United States. So we're looking at how do we stop these people? By exposing them, by stop turning off the television and stop being brainwashed by their nonsense, by demanding, by getting people in to our government that care, that are smart enough to figure this out. Because the same people that perpetrated this basically run Hollywood and the media. So again, we have Barbara Olson, who had spent a decade in Hollywood and worked for the media. So it's a very much CIA Mossad type of thing. Now, don't think for a minute that the CIA hasn't gone rogue and hasn't been completely infiltrated by a foreign government, because I have a lot of people telling me that they have. So there's some really interesting information that is coming forward to me from people that are scientists that are trying to tell me about some of the high technology weaponry that was quite possibly used on the towers that you and I probably still can't even fathom in our imaginations. So what do we do? Well, we have to be first aware that the New World Order is real, that this is a plan for total world government. It's biblical. If you read the Book of Mormon, you're going to see that we are in Helaman 5, and the evil people seem to have us outnumbered. So my advice to people is that you need to be prepared in every aspect for anything to happen. Now, I don't know if you're aware that this being the month of September for the Shemitah, and there's a wrapped up things with the Jubilee year, the 14th anniversary of 9/11. There's solar things happening, planetary alignments happening. And this is a month that we could see something like a nuclear 9/11. Don't forget, the same people who pulled this off have infiltrated the security of this country. We have no national security whatsoever. They control our nuclear reactors, our nuclear weapons, our biological weapons, and our chemical weapons, and the security around every nuclear reactor and our dams. So if they want to pull off a false flag event like 9/11 was and blame it on Iran or Syria or whoever is their chosen enemy, they can easily do that because they have access through the computer systems. They can melt down a nuclear reactor, or they can do just about anything. So we're very, very vulnerable. Maybe they haven't killed me because they haven't found me. I don't know. Maybe they don't want me to be a martyr because I'm just writing novels. And if they did, then you would all know that we're in a heap of trouble because nothing I wrote wasn't true. And the reason I put an appendix in the second book is so that you know that this is real research. And the people that are coming forward to me are real. And they're real enough to get an affidavit signed by a notary and offer to go to a court of law. Now, how do we get there? The infiltration is so bad that our judicial system is pretty well handled by them as well. So if you pray, I would pray for this country. If you vote, I would vote them out. And how do you find someone with the integrity that we need to have to run this country? I wish I had the answer for you. Since we are in a position of Helaman 5, and that seems that the evil has overpowered the good, we seem like we're outnumbered, even though we have them outnumbered, that collectively, if we unite in knowledge by waking other people up, sharing my books, and helping them see that this was a charade, and that get people to turn off their television because they're being brainwashed. If you just look into the CIA and television, you'll see that. That's why they call it programming. This has been a brainwashing thing that's been going on since the 50s. And if you're old enough to see the difference and look back 20 years ago, you never saw homosexuality in primetime television. You never saw perversion and sexual things like you do now. And it's every day. Same thing with movies. And the things, even our children's clothing. So you have to pay attention that really it does seem as though Satan is in control right now. So the best thing you can do is be prepared. And when I say that, I mean to as soon as you possibly can. And if you're broke, and that's okay, I've been there too. You want to go to a Winco store or one of those big box stores or Costco, and you want to buy as much oatmeal and rice and things like that that you can afford. You don't need to worry about a life shelf life of 30 years because we probably don't have that much time. You want to get stuff, and even if you think you have something, get something for your neighbors and people in your surrounding, your family, your church, your ward people, and unite together in knowledge. That is probably the best thing that you can do. And make sure that you are prepared now, like yesterday. And don't dilly-dally. This is not the time to put it on the shelf. This is the time to start filling up your water jugs and get your oatmeal, your rice, whatever you can, and put it aside and get as much stuff as you can afford that you can get through anything. Because listen, if I actually found in a real newspaper, and the thing that really tripped me up is that in that newspaper article where it said that the Al-Qaeda was going to attack five or six major cities in the United States with biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons, not one newspaper or what, not one news organization in the United States mentioned that. Just this one Ynet news out of Israel. And that was a red flag for me. That to me told me that somebody was giving a message much like the Odigo text message service that told those people, don't go to work in the World Trade Center today. Don't go into the trade towers today. And so 4,000 people got that message and didn't go to work that day. And that's one reason why we didn't see that many people killed in the towers, because 4,000 people were given a message. And so maybe that article I read was that message, but that's what I would prepare for, an EMP where you lose all your power. And make sure you can cook your food and that you have food and you have enough to sustain yourself. Excuse me, because quite frankly, I believe that it's going to collapse pretty soon and food is going to be better than any kind of gold or money. You can't eat gold or silver, and you can help your fellow man to survive and rally together and be the righteous people that bring this country back, because it's about to take a fall. And I firmly believe that, and everything that I've seen is that it's pretty much on the horizon, and it could happen in September. I'm not saying that it will, but I'm saying you should be looking at being ready by Sunday, by tomorrow, yesterday. Yeah, that's good. Somebody did ask about a Tomahawk cruise missile, and yes, it actually, when something hit the North Tower, it came in as a Cessna, and it came in as a missile being launched from the Woolworth Tower. And if you slow down the Naudette brothers' film, they're the only ones with the film of the North Tower being hit. That whatever it is actually spiraling, and I'm here to tell you that a 767 is not going to spiral. It can't go that fast, that close to the ground. So it was more than likely some type of missile. And if those art students that were there taking a window out and building a balcony and using all those fuses that can be used for remote control demolition as well as regular wiring, well, since the towers were already wired, we have to ask what were they doing with all of those fuses? So more than likely, they were making sure that where the quote unquote planes hit, that whole wall blew up. And that's probably what those things were. That's my guess. I just have to guess. I wasn't there. Thank you, guys. All right, you're so welcome.